listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is Thursday, December 13th. And if you are a orca lover, a Puget Sound salmon lover, you are probably watching the news today as Governor Inslee announced his proposed budget. And also, he unveiled his sort of orca package that followed along with and was responded to the Orca Task Force's recommendations. And so on today's breaking news podcast, we are going to be talking with Monica Whelan-Shields from the Orca Behavior Institute, who we've talked to many times in the past. And we're going to be just kind of giving our initial reactions to this. Obviously, this is a lot to take in and to digest and to look through and to analyze. But to just give all of you listeners some ideas of what this looks like. Is this good? Is this bad? What does it all mean? And so we will be chatting with her very shortly. We are back here on the Whale Scout Podcast with Monica Whelan-Shields from the Orca Behavior Institute. Hello, Monica.
Hi, Whitney. How are you doing?
Okay. We are here today to give our initial response to Governor Inslee's budget announcement and his unveiling of his orca recovery package. So what are your initial thoughts, Monica, when you first saw the announcement?
My first response was that it's a bit of a mixed bag. There are some good things in there and some things that we hoped for. And then there are some things that are missing or changed or maybe not as good as we had hoped for. So I think it's a mix.
Yeah, I was at I was in Seattle at an in-person, annual meeting all day long. And we had this scheduled long in advance of when Governor Inslee had scheduled this, announcement. And we just had to pause the meeting and everyone watch on live stream and literally get the information from the Seattle Times from Linda Mapes' article. And it was really kept such a secret before it came out. I was surprised by that.
Yeah, we really didn't have any information since the task force sent in their final list of recommendations. We didn't know if Inslee was going to adhere to that list or pick and choose from that list or come up with his own ideas. So it really was a mystery to all of us until today.
Yeah, and there were rumors going around. I know that the tribes had a consultation with Governor Inslee. And lots of behind the scenes, talks back and forth. And of course, the legislature in Olympia is gearing up for the next steps. And so, yeah, but really no idea. And it came as a surprise to everyone. And when I first saw Governor Inslee stand up and it was the announcement, $1.1 billion. And it was like, holy crap, that's a lot of money. That was my reaction.
Yeah, that was my reaction, too. I think I first saw it on the Seattle Times headline, and Linda Mapes called it billion-dollar bolt. And that was my first reaction, too, was that is a lot of money, and hopefully it's going to be directed to the right project. But it's a big ask, for sure.
Yeah, and then everyone wanted to know, okay, well, that $1 billion, where is that all going? What's that all going to go towards? And so there was the frantic search online of the line items. And I think, also the surprise of the governor included a whale-watching moratorium. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, that was a surprise because of the whole way it came about. It was a real 11th-hour proposal from the task force, and it came with a lot of controversy. It, of course, didn't have a lot of stakeholder input. It didn't have any public or scientific input. So that was one of the biggest question marks going into today and probably one of the biggest shockers that he decided to go forward with that.
Yeah, and another surprise to me, too, was to increase the approach distance to 400 yards for orcas. And that's something that the task force also had left behind.
Yeah, it's the first action I'm aware of where Inslee actually went kind of above and beyond what the task force had recommended to go even further. That was something that had been on the table earlier on in task force discussions, but had kind of been left behind. And right now we're hearing that it sounds like that 400 yards would apply to all killer whales, and that's a really big deal and will have some serious impacts to the whale watch industry going forward if that stands.
Yeah, it certainly will. You know, one thing that was interesting, I just now went back and I watched the full thing because our connection in this meeting was terrible. We missed the first part of Mindy Roberts from Washington Environmental Council actually introduced. She was the first speaker and introduced the topic and the governor and then later Senator Ranker. But the very first question that she asked to the audience was, how many of you have seen a wild orca, right? And lots of people in the audience raised their hand and she said, wow, that's so amazing. Isn't the experience just incredible to witness them? You know, it does something to you and it pulls at your heartstrings and you don't ever want to asked that question to a room full of people and have had no one ever seen an orca, right? So it's like...
Oh, it's so true.
It's so true. And what she meant was them to be extinct. But I think she was also like, the point is that I'm hearing was that it is so important for stakeholders and constituents to have that connection, that personal connection to what they're trying to save, right?
It absolutely is, and I've seen a lot of comments in response to this proposed moratorium that say, well, just watch them from shore, right? And that used to be a really great viable option for viewing the southern residents here, but with their change in travel patterns, they've become much more sporadic visitors to the Salish Sea. You know, it used to be in the summer from May through September, they would pass Limekiln Lighthouse on Salmon Island on almost a daily basis, and that's just not the case anymore. There's weeks, sometimes close to a month, between sightings of them out there, and their visits into Puget Sound have been a little more irregular. And then the transient killer whales that the whale-watching boats have been viewing most of the time, I think something like 80 or 85% of their killer whale viewing is of these transient killer whales, they're really more difficult to view from shore. They're going yes. a lot longer dives. They're more sporadic in their travel patterns. So viewing killer whales from shore, the truth is it's not quite what it used to be, you know, 15 years ago.
Yes, it's, you know, it's something that obviously that we play a big part in and we will continue to do. And it comes from a belief that connecting with the whales and having a personal experience is very important. I'm reading this book. I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent. I'm reading this book right now called The Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv. And it's all about, you know, people's connection to nature and how it's important for our health and the environment. And, you know, he talks about this idea of environmentalists not wanting any kids to go out into the woods and build a fort or a treehouse because it might, you know, cause a little bit of damage to the trees and the little, you know, microhabitats for little critters. And the author argues that, you know, whatever small little impact that might happen to this forest is significantly outweighed by the benefits that those kids have to, you know, to building constituents and future voters that will vote to protect that forest because that's where they grew up, right? So, you know, I think that whale watching is kind of like that. And the task force had put together these recommendations that would allow for responsible whale watching that would get to a point where the whale watching boats would be less of would have you know, I don't want to say zero impact, but basically zero impact where there are other vessels that are out there that are causing noise and disturbance. And so it's kind of like that for me. And I just I think it's important for people to have that option and the ability to connect with whales.
Absolutely. I think that's true for nature across the board that, you know, there's something to be said for learning about it from books and movies and from behind the screen, but there's no substitute for getting your fingers in the dirt and being out there. And it's absolutely true for whale watching. It's a life-changing experience to see killer whales in the wild, and the whale watch industry makes that accessible to a lot more people.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk now a little bit about some of those line items in the budget, $1.1 billion. Where is that money going? On the governor's website, he posted a little policy brief, and at the very bottom, it gives a breakdown of some of where the money is going. And so if you just look down through the list, the biggest line item is $296 million from the transportation budget for culvert replacement. What was your reaction to that?
That's a really big number. I mean, that's almost a third of the proposed so-called ORCA budget. And it's an important project because it'll do a lot for improving fish habitat. But my understanding was that, like, the culvert removal was kind of mandated already and that was something that had to go forward anyway. Do you think I was misreading that, or was that your understanding as well?
That was my understanding as well. You know, the history on that is that the treaty tribe in the state of Washington have sued Washington State, and this summer it was brought all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the ruling was in favor of the tribes. It said these culverts, these basically pipes under roads that allow the streams to cross through, were too small or not big enough or the wrong design for fish to go up or back down. And and that was a huge deal because it's really, really, really expensive. And the state is now legally required to fix those roads. And so that $300 million is really in response to that. It's sort of putting the ORCA label on something else. I've talked with a lot of different people in the salmon recovery world that say that, you know, of course, we should be doing this for the fish themselves and for the tribes, absolutely. But these culverts are not really a big impact on Chinook. So I believe in the task force recommendations, it listed to prioritize burial removal for Chinook. And I think this kind of misses the mark.
Yeah, I would agree, and I totally agree that this is kind of putting the ORCA spin on something that was already happening. Like, those of us who've been following these issues closely this year, like, celebrated this as a important victory earlier on in the year, but it was not, you know, it wasn't necessarily a killer whale victory. And again, it's kind of something that was already in motion, and sort of tacking that on maybe to make the billion-dollar mark, you know, that's $300 million towards it. Spinning the story a little bit.
Yeah. So, not really a great win in my mind, but it is for the orcas at least. But I think it is, like you said, a big win for the tribes and for the fish themselves. You know, fish like coho are really going to benefit from this. So going down the list now, the next highest line item is $143 million from the capital budget for toxics cleanup and stormwater. What was your take on that?
To me, this was one of the biggest victories from the proposed budget, is that a lot of these big toxin issues have kind of been pushed under the rug a little bit because everyone says, oh, it's going to take so long to have any effect. And that's true, but to me, that's even more of a reason to start now so we start seeing some of these impacts. And this is something that's really not just going to ultimately benefit killer whales, but it's going to benefit every creature living in the Salish Sea, and that includes us.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of money in there for toxic waste cleanup, and then there's a lot of money for stormwater management, and those are two really big items that absolutely we have to address, both for killer whales and for a whole host of other reasons. So I saw that number as a big victory.
Yes, I did too. You know, the stormwater issue is so big, and we really need to get a handle on it, and so I give this a thumbs up.
Yeah, again, though, it's important to the killer whales, but it's not going to be the make or break for the killer whales in the next 5-10 years. So it's an important piece of the pie, but not enough on its own, for sure.
Yeah. Going down the list, the next highest line item, this one really surprised me, $117 million from the transportation budget again to electrify the state ferries. And the reason why this surprised me is because I went to a lot of the vessel working group meetings, and there was a representative there from from the Washington State Ferries and talked about another executive order that Inslee had put forward to work on reducing carbon emissions. And in that other executive order, one of the things that they were required to do was to electrify the state ferries. So yes, this does help make quieter ferries is what my understanding is. But I think you're kind of double counting here, you know, for you're saying it's great for emissions, but then you're also saying, oh, but this is a good Orca thing too. And I think you can't claim that victory twice.
Yeah, I had the exact same reaction. This is definitely, again, putting the Orca label on something that's already in motion. My jaw hit the floor on that $117 million amount. That's a big portion of the $1 billion on the table. And when you dig into it, they say it's going to go toward building two hybrid electric ferries and converting two ferries to electric. And it's true that that makes the vessels a lot quieter, but that's talking about four ferries in the whole region. And when you look at the underwater soundscape as a whole and where the southern residents are traveling, that's a pretty small piece of it. So bigger victory for sure for the state in terms of reducing carbon emissions and setting a good precedent. But I agree, pretty big price tag and double counting as doing something for the whales. It's pretty darn minor.
Yeah. Well, what are your, do you have any other thoughts about other big wins that you're really happy to see?
I kind of wait a little bit to see how it's all going to play out. There's a lot in there about salmon habitat recovery, which is a positive thing. I think, proposed recommendation number one from the task force was all about fully funding salmon habitat restoration throughout the state. And that was one of the most broadly supported action items, and I think one of the most key action items, because we have a lot of work that's been done to identify where we can get the most bang for our buck in terms of recovering salmon, specifically Chinook salmon and chum when it comes to the southern residents. And it sounds like from this proposed budget that a lot of money is going towards habitat recovery. But maybe you can shed some insight on how close it came to that fully funding target.
Sure. And I will say I totally jumped the gun. And I said I started at the top of the list with the highest budget line items, but I missed that out of the capital budget, the habitat restoration projects at $376 million is the highest. So I apologize for that. But that obviously it seems like a huge number, and it is. And I had a quick chat with some of my friends in the salmon recovery world, and I said, okay, well, there's a lot of programs that are within that, those habitat restoration. You know, what happened? Did, you know, the Puget Sound Acquisition Restoration Fund, how did that fall out? How did some of our other big programs like the estuary restoration program? And so the general sense that I have out of it is that, you know, some of the programs got a little bit of a boost and other ones didn't. So let me see. I'm going to pull up here some of the numbers. What happens is that there's a biennial budget for 2 years. So this budget we're talking about right now is for 2 years. And you can compare it to the budget that was put out for 2017, 2019. And what happens is that the agencies will put in a request, and then the Governor Inslee and the legislature will then fulfill that request at whatever level comes out of the whole process. And so we're kind of going back and comparing. So let's take a look at some of the numbers here. So for the Puget Sound Acquisition and Restoration Fund, these are the list, the rank list that, from the large capital that we talked about with Jeanette Dorner a few months ago. That one, there was $42.5 million, which is significantly below what was asked. Let's see here. There was about $79.6 is what was asked. So 42.5 is, you know, about half of that. If you remember, the number one item on that list was the Middle Fork Nooksack Dam removal, and I believe that one came in at like $20 million for that cost. So that can kind of give you some perspective on where this money is going and how far it stretches. Let's see. I'll see if I can find some more. So the Salmon Recovery Funding Board programs, the last biennium was $19.7 million, and this year they asked for $88.9 million, and the governor allotted $85? Oh boy, I'm going to goof on my numbers here. Sorry, the Surf Board received $36 million. So again, some of these programs, you know, got a little bit of a boost and other ones didn't. But from what I'm hearing from the salmon recovery folks is that people are not super excited about, you know, the bold budget request that they were hoping for. So it was a little bit of a letdown for those guys.
So it sounds like it definitely fell well short of the mark of fully funding, right? Like some groups got a boost, some were kind of status quo, like, that's okay, but that's not the kind of victory we were looking for on what's, I think, pretty widely agreed as the most important issue is salmon and their habitat.
Yeah, and you know, when you look at these programs, about 80% of the money that is allocated through these funds benefits Chinook. So it's a pretty good way that they're distributing these funds. I would argue it's more efficient than culvert removal at targeting Chinook. So I personally would have liked to see more money go into these programs that are already established, that are already doing the work, and there are projects that are waiting to go that just need the money. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, so these have been researched, their effects have been identified, and they're basically shovel ready, right? They just need the funding. So this is something that could start right away.
Yes, a lot of these are. So it was pretty disappointing. So I think that there's an opportunity to keep working on this in Olympia, to keep advocating for more funding to be going to these programs, and to keep the heat on. Like, we didn't, recommendation number one, we didn't get it. So we've got work to do.
Yeah. Disappointing on that one.
Yeah. Let's see. Are there any other programs that you want to talk about that you feel like missed the mark, hit the mark?
I feel like there's the two other most controversial topics we should at least touch on. One being the Lower Snake River Dams.
Yes.
Inslee did move forward with the creation of the stakeholder panel. It remains to be seen, I guess, how exactly that will play out, what their mandate is, who's in charge of it. It almost sounded like from something I read that it would be kind of under the purview of the task force. So while we agree that that's an important step, to address stakeholder concerns and develop a mitigation plan for the hopeful eventual breaching of those dams, it maybe wasn't worded quite as boldly, as we had hoped. And I think Inslee said somewhere that he's still kind of not really made a decision on the Snake River dams and is going to wait to see how the panel plays out and how the federal process going on simultaneously plays out.
Yes, and I have a question for you. I have not followed up on the spill recommendation. Have you?
On which?
The spill recommendation to spill more water over the dams.
Yeah, that one was a big miss, in my opinion.
What happened? Fill me in.
So the proposal was to increase spill over the eight dams, you know, the four Lower Snake River dams and the four dams on the Lower Columbia. And to me, that was one of the boldest, most obvious actions that was going to have an immediate impact on increasing salmon survival in that river system. And it's being tied up in a three-year decision-making process. The way it's written right now. And my understanding was that was something that the state could take action on and maybe implement almost immediately. So the fact that it's kind of not a guarantee and being tied up for three more years is politics, I think. And that was a big disappointment for me.
Okay, so there's no spill going to be happening next year.
That's my understanding. It looked like... it read as a three-year decision-making process, and then that maybe in 3 years we would start to see increased spill. And again, it's early and all the details haven't come out, so I'm hoping that's not correct, but it's definitely looking like kind of kicking the can down the line on that one and not taking the immediate action that we need.
That's surprising to me because, you know, like in the middle of the task force process, that reporter Simone Del Rosario from Q13, she had that interview with Governor Inslee where she just hounded him over the Snake River dams and wouldn't drop the issue. And it really seemed like in that interview, from my memory, that Inslee felt like spill was a good option. So, seems like he should have been more supportive of that. I wonder what sort of conversations have happened since now and then.
Yes, spill has kind of been something that's been offered sort of in exchange for not talking about dam removal from cases. So I fully expected there to be legitimate action on that front, with maybe not quite the bold action on the Snake River dams that we hoped for. The Bonneville Power Administration holds a lot of political sway in the state, and I'm sure that in one way or another that played a piece in this decision.
I do have one piece of insider information that it will not be facilitated by the same facilitators that have been working with the task force. So I don't know what that means, but...
This is the stakeholder panel?
Correct, yes.
It'll be really interesting to see who is on that, right? Like, is it really going to be a full representation of all the interest groups, or... is it going to be the healthy discussions that we need, or is it going to be the same people reaffirming their status quo that the dams are fine the way that they are? So it's, jury's out on how that'll play out, but hopefully it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. And I think it'll be the work of all of us and environmental groups and ORCA advocates to keep the pressure on to help implement all of these. I mean, this is such a long process. A lot of these things now have to go through Olympia, and a lot of these things, too, in the task force report had date deadlines listed with them. And so I think we need to be keeping a careful eye on those deadlines and making sure that those things are happening.
Absolutely. It's going to be a total marathon. It's not a sprint, and there's going to be a lot of moving pieces to keep track of in the next year as some of these recommendations work their way through the state legislature, and then we'll have the task force meeting for their second year and coming up with presumably additional recommendations as well.
That's right. Do you know when the first task force meeting is in year two?
I don't. I'm not sure if they've announced that schedule yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I'm trying to mentally prepare to go back in and keep working on this and keep following it. As critical as both of us are on what was just released today and then this whole process, I think overall, when you take a really big step back, we've never had this much attention and interest. I mean, think about it. Like, our governor just got up there to announce his budget and talked about orcas for, a lot of the time. That's a big deal. So
it is a big deal. And it's definitely a shift from what we've seen before. And I think that's true in Canada as well. So both sides of the border, the killer whales really have an attention and a public interest that they haven't had before. And it's just up to all of us to kind of keep that public pressure on, because that's really what's moving all of this forward.
Yeah. Yeah. The Government of Canada, they put forward a good chunk of change. Do you remember what that totaled off the top of your head?
I don't, I know it included some significant salmon habitat restoration, and then they've also extended the southern resident critical habitat as well to include some areas on the outer coast. So hopefully we'll see the same thing in the U.S. as well.
Yeah, I was about to go off on that tangent as well. But I was just curious to compare sort of like the state of Washington's, ORCA package compared to what's been proposed in other areas. And I think, too, it would be so great to have Oregon and California get a little bit more on board with these efforts as well. I mean, you could consider Washington State and Canada as leading the way. And truly, the state of California, I think, has, and Oregon as well, they have a lot of restoration potential and are also sources of salmon that the orcas need desperately.
Yeah, and as we're facing some, long-term recovery on the Columbia and Snake Rivers and on the Fraser River, like some of those rivers that may have been more periphery food sources for the southern residents might take on a more important role to, hopefully get them through these leaner times up here. So things like the removal of the dams on the Klamath River will be so important, I think, for the southern residents. And that's sort of something that hasn't gotten the Orca label so much yet, but maybe it should.
Yeah, that is true. That one actually deserves the Orca label, perhaps.
It does.
Yeah, they should catch wind of that. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I just thought it would be good to give some of our initial reactions to what happened today, this, you know, breaking news kind of podcast. And, you know, you and I and others will continue to be working on this and a lot of other issues. And I hope to talk with you again as we keep moving forward with this and you know, see everything through the legislature in Olympia. It's going to be a crazy winter.
It is. And I do think there's one other topic I wanted to mention briefly, and that has to do with the pinnipeds.
Yes.
Because there's so much attention in the media right now about the, you know, approval of more lethal removal of pinnipeds on the Columbia River. And then there's been illegal shootings of sea lions in Puget Sound. And this was, again, a topic that was on the list of task force recommendations. And for people that are curious about that, it does sound like Inslee is moving forward with increased studies in Puget Sound and presumably the outer coast as well, to see the impact of pinnipeds on salmon in the region. And hopefully this will include a real ecosystem level analysis. I think it's important that it happens because there's a lot of pressure from, you know, certain stakeholders to address this issue. And I think it does need to be looked at, hopefully, by an independent science panel that can kind of come in and assess, like I said, the ecosystem level impacts. Because as we know, the transient killer whales are eating a lot of seals and sea lions. And I think it's really key that we consider, you know, what effects is it going to have up and down the food chain? So there's, I think, just over $4 million in the governor's proposal to study this further. So no direct actions in terms of culling in Puget Sound as of yet, but this is a topic I think we're going to be talking about a lot in the next couple of years.
Yes, it is. And it's been really kind of scary living down here in the Seattle area and knowing that these sea lions are being shot at what appears to be like a regular basis right now. And like, there's no evidence, like no one's hearing gunshots. I mean, this is happening in like Elliott Bay. And these whales, there are not whales, these sea lions are washing ashore in West Seattle. I mean, some of like the densest population, you know, in the state. And it's just bizarre. And I can't help but think that some of the things that are happening right now on the Columbia River through this task force are almost validating these killings, really.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I also think, from, you know, those people's perspectives, there's maybe not enough action happening on that front. So they're taking matters into their own hands.
Yeah.
And until, you know, some clear mandates come down in terms of how we're going to address this going forward or if we're going to address it, I have a feeling we're going to see more of this before the situation resolves one way or another.
Right. Yeah. Your group, the Orca Behavior Institute, just released a paper detailing transients as a culling specialist, perhaps, and sort of doing a natural cull. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So we took actual sightings of identified transients in the Salish Sea from the Pacific Whale Watch Association in 2017, which was a record year for those mammal-eating killer whales in inland waters. And we developed a bioenergetic model to estimate how many seals they're actually eating when they're here. And we made the most conservative estimate possible. So anywhere where we could choose kind of a range of values or make guesses, we guessed on the low end to come up with a minimum estimate. And we estimated that at a minimum, they ate 1,090 harbor seals while in inland waters in 2017. And a lot of people's first reaction was that that number sounded kind of low. And, well, it might be low because it is a conservative estimate, but when you do the math, it actually adds up to quite a bit. It's on par with some of the other kind of back-of-the-napkin calculations we've heard about them eating tens of thousands of seals each year throughout British Columbia. And it's actually on par with some of the proposed cullings that, in terms of percent of the population being removed each year, that's kind of in the range of what's being talked about to help control the seal population. So I think they are culling specialists. They're better at it than we are, and they're doing it arguably in a much more natural way. So given a little bit of time, I think the transients will help put a more of a check on the seal population. And while numbers haven't been published, some of the unpublished data, it looks like seal populations have been declining already over the last 10 to 15 years. And with the transients continuing to increase, 2018, there were even more of them in inland waters than in last year. They're going to take care of the population themselves. So that's the kind of data that's really key for independent scientists to kind of assess before we move forward with some of these lethal management solutions that could have a whole host of unintended consequences.
You know, and hey, since we've been talking about budget this whole time, I think someone ought to say, hey, the transients are doing this for free, huh?
That's true. There's limited dollars, and there's a lot of budgetary priorities, and we've got seal cullers coming in here and doing the job for free. That's a really good point.
Yeah, use it. Now, I have not heard anyone say that one yet. So, but you know what I did hear? Just the other day, I did a podcast with Jacques White from Long Live the Kings, and he made a mention about even not just like, you know, whale eat seal kind of interactions, but just the presence of transient killer whales in Puget Sound could have an impact on the behavior of these seals, which I thought was kind of an interesting reach for him to make.
Yeah, I would totally believe that, you know, a mammal without a predator around might get complacent, might hang out in the same area and gorge on fish more often, you know, than they would otherwise. But if you're spending time looking out for a predator and trying to avoid a predator that's maybe more common than they were before, that would absolutely change your behavior in terms of where you're spending your time, what you're eating, all of that. So I think that's a good point that they would change where the seals are and what they're doing, as well as physically removing some of them.
Yeah, I thought I would have like a smart aleck remark like, well, we should bring some transients up to the Bonneville Dam and have them hang out there and change some pinniped behavior, but I saved it.
Well, yeah. You used it now.
Yeah. I feel more comfortable with you, Monica. But, you know, like...
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part with the Columbia River situation, and I think why the culling has moved forward there quicker, because the transients do not go up the river, and there are some real problem issues there with pinnipeds kind of concentrating at these pinch points, and it's a tough situation. But
yeah,
up here in the Salish Sea, I think it's a very different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, visit the locks regularly, and they still have steelhead written on their placards. We don't have steelhead in, you know, going through the locks anymore because they were eaten by pinnipeds. And it was a big issue way back then, and it didn't really get resolved. And you know, for a lot of different reasons, I don't really, you know, want to put all the blame on Herschel. You know, like at the Marine Mammal Commission meeting, someone said, you know, this wouldn't be a problem if the dams weren't there, right? So it's kind of the same.
Yep.
With the locks. You know, we built this human concrete wall, and so, you know, and one of the issues too that I brought up with Jacques from Long Live the Kings is that while on one hand, you know, some people are asking for pinniped management, you know, they're also asking for increased hatchery production, and it's those little smolts that, you know, in the case of the harbor seals that they're preying upon. And it's almost kind of like, you know, in some instances, you know, and I wouldn't say hand feeding, but it's making it really easy for those seals to be eating and reproducing.
Yeah, ringing the dinner bell.
Exactly,
sure.
Exactly. So I, you know, I think that we had to think obviously about this in a holistic way, and so I thank you for your work in doing that and bringing more of the scientific discussions, you know, about the food web to the forefront.
Yeah, you know, to some extent, for a lot of these issues, it feels like we're revisiting the past a little bit with, you know, should we cull pinnipeds in this region and should we boost hatchery production and who are we boosting hatchery production for and how are we doing it? I mean, these are issues that we've addressed before and maybe didn't address very well in the past. And I think there's a lot of fear right now that we'll make the same mistakes again. But, you know, those decisions are on the table right now and we have to try and influence a different outcome this time around and maybe a healthier outcome for the whole ecosystem.
Right, right. So, yeah, I'm reading the operating budget right now for hatchery production and a few other things, $36.6 million. So I think I read somewhere, you know, the numbers of fish that they're trying to produce in these hatcheries and kick out to the environment. And it's like, you kind of wonder how many of those are going to be just chowed down by seals. You know, all those dollars and cents going right into the mouths of the seals that people want to slaughter. So it's, you know, you kind of have to think about those things sometimes and really push for some of the science to review how those hatcheries are being managed and what can be done to really and be mindful of how we're spending our money, to be honest.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know people are desperate for that kind of silver bullet solution right now for these whales, but they're complicated issues. And that's why these you know, these problems haven't been solved before. And we are lucky that all of this is on the table right now and there are options for real change, but it is going to take a lot of, you know, research and understanding of the facts and a lot of advocating for science and to make sure that kind of the, you know, healthy, sustainable decisions are made across the board.
Yeah. Yeah. I said in my comments at the very first task force meeting, May 1st, I said, you know, we've been tinkering with the environment for a long time and it's gotten us to this place. And I don't think that tinkering is going to get us back out, you know. So I think it's has to be, you know, healing the ecosystem as a whole, which is why I personally have been pushing so hard for habitat restoration and letting, you know, nature heal herself and investing in it now and then seeing that as a sustainable solution moving into the future.
Absolutely. It's, you know, getting out of the way, I think, is what we can do. And that's why I think some of the best actions are, you know, removing the toxins from the environment, removing the barriers to fish passage. And we've seen how resilient salmon can be time and time again. And I think we just need to take out some of these, you know, various barriers, physical and otherwise, that we've put in place. And I agree with you, that will be the most sustainable solution going forward.
Yeah. Well, Monica, I want to just thank you for chatting with me tonight. It was good to catch up and to sort of digest some of this together. And I hope it was helpful for our listeners. Is there anything else that you want to add tonight?
I think just that we plan to kind of come up with some sort of distilled document for the public to help digest this, right? So you and I have partnered with Cindy Hansen and Susan Marie Anderson to come up with kind of the bold action guides. And I think we plan to kind of take a little bit of a deeper dive into this budget request and how it compares to the task force recommendations. And sometime in the next few days or a week, we'll come up with something that we'll be able to share to maybe distill some of this a little further.
Yeah, we the four of us would like to continue offering our listeners and followers a way to stay engaged and to try and just keep tabs on this long and complicated process. So look forward to that from us. And yeah, it'll be great.
Yep, lots to follow, lots to discuss. So we all just got to keep at it.
All right. And if you want more information about from Monica Whelan Shields, you can go up to their website, OrcaBehaviorInstitute.org, right?
That's correct.
Okay, good. And thank you so much. And we'll talk to you again very soon.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening today. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can go up to whalescout.org to look for past episodes. You can also subscribe on iTunes, and these podcast episodes will be sent right to your phone. As I mentioned before, we've interviewed Monica Whelan Shields several times in the past. So if you enjoyed hearing from her today, be sure to go back and check out some of her previous episodes. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. J'esquive conseils et préjugés.